You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I am speaking to Ramon Rivas II, who I believe is the first, the second we've had on the show. Hello, Ramon. Ramon is a comedian in Lorain, Ohio, who lives in abundance as an artist, despite his lack of financial privilege. I'm quite pleased with that as a sentence. We're going to get on to what all of that stuff means quite soon. I've described him in the show notes as a comedian and go-getter. What I really wanted to describe him as was a hustler, but I think unless you hear the nuance of someone's voice as they deliver that, it could probably be misinterpreted. But Ramon is someone who I think I feel a certain kinship with in our shared excitement about not just grafting to make your way in comedy, but grafting in a sort of, I don't know, I can't find the right word that says hustler without there being any negative connotations. I remember I was at the LA Podcast Festival a good few years ago now, and I think I was the first English person that had been there, and I was working the line. I'd kind of overnight printed out a bunch of flyers to try and get some of the podcast otaku who were in the room, the super fans, in that convention centre, the Beverly Hills Hotel, I think it was, to try and encourage them along to get into my room to come and see my live podcast, up against, as it was, real big names in American comedy podcasting. And so I was kind of working the line, flyering people, and they said, oh, no one really does that. We admire your hustle. So in that sense, it's that kind of sense, a hustle that is to be admired, which is what Ramon is all about. He's a very funny comic. He's a big guy. And we talk about being big, broke, and brown. And we get into, I mean, one of the fascinating things from a UK perspective, which we will get into, is Ramon's discovery that in Edinburgh, at the Edinburgh Festival in 2019, on his first trip, he was perceived as white by his audiences. And what that made, I mean, I've actually included in the show notes of this a link to Ramon delivering that story as a kind of, as material, but as a true story as well. There's a video link in this episode. You can also get it at his website, blazerramon.com. It's really worth listening to because it is a really fascinating insight on race. It's a really interesting way in which to look at Ramon's discovery of himself and how he holds himself and how those things are affected by the issue of race, particularly the issue of race in America, and then coming to somewhere very different to America, what light that threw on that subject. So I'll let Ramon get into all of this, but it's a really fun conversation, and there is some extras available, 40 minutes of extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, or if you're already in the Insiders Club, simply find it on your private personal podcast, where we will talk about some of Ramon's outre tactics for making comedy pay. Including a really kind of fleshed out and exploded diagram, if you like, of his strategy with DistroKid. We'll also talk about weed comedy for the first time on this podcast. That's you might get the @BlazerRamon on Twitter, and BlazerRamon.com is a reference to drugs. We'll get into that on the insider stuff. But for now, let's get stuck into this podcast with Ramon. I've been really enjoying your stuff. You sent me loads of clips. I've listened to your stuff on Spotify. And what I really enjoy about your material is the fact that, obviously, the word laid back will get bandied around every time anyone talks about you, because the pace of it is sort of very deliberately slow. It's a very refreshing listen because you go, oh, there we go. This guy's letting me come to him. And yeah. One of the things I've really been enjoying is the way that your delivery really suits your narrative. It suits your persona. It suits who you are and where you're coming from. And something I really enjoyed, one of the first kind of sit up and like, oh, that's really good. You were talking about poverty and being good at poverty, which is an original angle. But also, it was really interesting to hear about someone, like comedy now is so full of people talking about their success. And I really enjoyed listening to someone talk about poverty and look to talk about good ways and kind of shrewd ways to be poor. And yeah. I wondered how much, I've never been to Ohio. I've just kind of wondered, we should start off with kind of your background and what your expectations are growing up in Ohio.
Okay. Lorraine used a big steelyard, shipyard, auto industry. So like my dad used to work at the steel mill when I was a kid. And so he's an electrician there. I'd always see him be kind of like unhappy or like complain about the type of treatment he'd get. Like he was a really good worker, so he'd have to do a bunch of stuff, but then like kind of his white coworkers would just be asked to do less because they wouldn't do it as well. Mm-hmm. And then my mom always worked at like nonprofits, and kind of would always be overqualified but undereducated. So like there were points where she was like working within like a foster care agency as just a driver, but knew enough from her time in past jobs that she would be like, oh, you're this caseworker's not advocating for their client correctly, or like stuff like that.
Yeah.
And would speak out and then be kind of like, that's not your job. So okay. Kind of like, and they'd also always kind of hustle. So like they had those jobs, but when they didn't, like my mom does massages and energy work and like different stuff. My dad is an electrician. So like now he does like, he works at Ford, but also does like, you know, contracting work on the side and does floors and like they can always hustle up something. Right. So both of them worked most of the time when I was a kid. So I was alone a lot. You know, I still have my sister, but like, you know, I started learning how to cook when I was like 8. I was like pretty independent most of the time. I play video games, fill my time and just, you know, do bullshit. But I feel like both of them working very hard to be exactly where they are kind of informed how I do comedy, because I do it the same kind of like hustle. Like I get, you know, pop up here, pop up there, like figure out how to make it happen, even if I'm not getting that appreciation from the business side of it or any like forward momentum as far as like, elevation within the ranks, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. But seeing my parents work like that just kind of prepared me for like, okay, you're not going to be fully appreciated by everyone in the place. Just do your thing. And, you know, that informed me kind of hustling, doing my own shows. But it also gave me the, because I grew up in like not abject poverty, but just at like the top of the lower class, like both my parents worked. If I wanted something, they'd get it. But I knew in order for them to get it, they'd be gone to work.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a correlation of time and emotion and money. Like those all are super intertwined for me. And so I didn't have a lot of expectations financially for myself. Mm-hmm. So comedy fit, because there's no financial stability within it.
Yeah.
It's almost all hustle, which I'm like, I have in spades.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but that kind of helps you get to a certain point, but then figuring out that like that business side of it and like how to properly advocate for yourself is like the thing I'm still struggling
sure, yeah, with. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned kind of rank there. Where do you, for people listening, the majority of my listeners in the UK, and they may have seen you at the Edinburgh Festival, but it was a pretty small room. Like, I think you not like toured here or something, her profile here.
That was my first time over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I knew that at the time. Where did we meet? Did we meet in Texas or did we meet?
We
in LA?
Met at South by Southwest, gotcha. In 2008. 2018 or 2017. I think it was the beginning of 2018. And then I went to Edinburgh that fall.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, okay. Because that's one of the things we were talking about. And then I knew you were going to turn up. And I saw your Edinburgh show. You were at the Stand. And we'll get into your experiences in Edinburgh. Some of them I've heard some of your stand-up about on Spotify.
Yeah.
But just give us a picture of kind of where you are. From your kind of description there, you know how to hustle, but it's kind of getting out of the lane of people hustling and into the lane where people call you. Is that where you're at the moment? Like trying to bridge the gap?
Yeah. So like when I first started, clubs would be like, we can't work you, you don't have credits, or you can't work you, you're not funny, which is fully understandable. You know, like it's irrational to apply for a job you're not qualified for and be mad you can't get it.
Yeah.
So that informed me, like I ran a lot of my own shows because, okay, I'm not funny enough to work for you, but I can do this open mic. I can do this showcase. And I got to the point where I was producing probably like two or three of my own shows a week. Mm-hmm. Plus like trying to work at the club. So over the years, I just slowly get in. Okay, now I'm hosting at this club. Okay, now I'm doing all my shows. I'm leaving the state and I come back and I'd be ready to get moved up, but I'd have to stay as a host and then get moved up. Everything's on a delay. You know what I'm saying? Like once you're ready, you kind of still get catered back. So now I'm at the point where, you know, in 2016, I started accumulating credits, which was the thing they always said that we can't work you or headline you because you don't have this thing. Mm-hmm. So then I got a Comedy Central special when I was living in Ohio without a manager, which is
crazy. That's very unusual, right? That's like, that doesn't happen.
Very unusual. They said it wasn't the first time it happened, okay, but it's a rare occasion. Uh-huh. But when I went and did that, I was meeting all these managers and agents who I'd emailed before from booking shows, right?
Yeah.
And I remember someone saying like, oh yeah, when I saw your name, I was like, Ramon Rivas, he's a talent buyer. Okay. So they knew my name, but not in the context of a comedian or an act. They knew me as a person they could call to try to route their clients.
Yeah, right.
So
was that frustrating? Just that feeling, like, was it frustrating to be like, they know me, but not for the thing I want them to know me for? Was it frustrating or was it like, were you happy to be known?
I was a mix of both, because it's like, oh, cool, you already know me from the hustle, from what I do. My name has crossed your lips, mm-hmm, which is random for a dude from Ohio. Mm-hmm. But it's also shitty because a lot of times the first way someone knows you is going to be the only way until you like are in a position to like knock that down. Mm-hmm. But it was also very interesting because I was the only one without representation. I had a lot of people coming at me and showing me interest, but had no knowledge or desire to actually know me. They just saw the name, saw the unattachment, and were like, "Ooh, you're a thing we can have."
Okay.
Because there was no, like, I had people, when I went to LA for the first time, I had these two manager dudes chase me through the show. Like, they saw me and they followed me because I was just walking through. And they're like, oh, yeah, we called you and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, cool, yeah, I'm here for a few weeks to set up a meeting. I'll come in. Never followed up. But chased me.
Yeah.
So it's like LA felt like a lot of that, like, okay, reaction to heat versus reaction to like actually, oh, let's build something here. Mm-hmm. And so I got the credits. And then when I lived in LA from 2016 to 2019, I started getting more. Like I popped up on a Netflix show, Cooking on High, which is like a cannabis cooking show. I got an HBO Latino special, so I'm on HBO Max. I got all these little logos, you know?
All unrepresented.
I had a manager for 1 year. I signed with a management company, and then, like, by the end of it, I was like, so what do y'all do? Because it was there were things we talked about in our first meeting that went unaddressed, and then, like I did a pilot presentation when I was with them. And they were like, oh, we got something for you. I'm like, did you? Because they emailed me and asked where to send an offer. Sure. And then now you're acting like you got that for me.
Yeah,
so it's like a lot of shit like that. So we parted ways. And then, like, so now I'm at a point where I have credits. I have, you know, I won't even say prestige. I have, if you look me up, you're like, oh, this dude's a comic.
He's got albums.
He's got specials. He's got appearances. This month he's done things cool. And that used to be when I first started comedy, that was enough that you could just work. Right. But now it's changed to where when I go to these places, I'm like, hey, I'd like to come in. Like, you know, here's my veil. Here's my thing. They're like, oh, yeah, you're not a draw, so we can't work you. And it's like, oh, that's not what you told. I could have tried. The goalpost keeps getting moved, but yeah. I see it not get moved for other people.
Sure.
So that's where I feel stuck at.
Because if what they'd said, or if you'd recognized 10 years ago, oh, what you need is a draw, and actually the kind of the baubles are immaterial. Like, as long as you can get tickets, as long as you can get people to buy tickets, it doesn't matter if you have, that's kind of what we're seeing now, I guess, with YouTubers who are like, I can shift an incredible amount of units without necessarily having the skill base that you're looking for or the credits.
Yeah.
So,
and I feel like the main thing with credits is that they prove that you can exist in this medium.
Yeah.
Right. So like now when a club's like, can you be clean for this? I'm like, I've been on TV for 30 minutes. Like, I'm good. Like, don't worry about it. But it also like, I knew enough to not let those matter to me. Cause like, even though I have done all these things, I'm still big, broken, brown. I'm still the same. Like I'm in Lorraine at my dad's house. Like I'm in the same position, even though I have all this other shit, but I'm more skilled than I've ever been. It's a weird duality.
Yeah. Okay. So do you think, and I'm just kind of like, I've got a certain amount of hustle. That's a hard thing to say, the very English way of putting it, but I have a certain amount of hustle. And I think I recognize the frustration in that of going, how can you apply the hustle that you have without the insight to know which direction you should be hustling in? I think a lot of us feel like that. You know, there's a lot of road miles being driven and a lot of stage time being had that we all hope is going in the right direction without real insight. And it's something I suppose I saw when people got really good representation very early on. You know, you come up together, you do new act competitions together, and you see some people just accelerate because they're getting the right advice and being pointed in the right direction. And then there are people who have a variety of things to lean back on, but certainly those people for whom it's like, well, it's hustle, it's get out there, knock on doors, make it happen, but doesn't have the same kind of, you don't have the kind of the time trial car in front of you to follow.
Yeah. And like I've had so many of my friends and peers that I've met over the years. Like I started going to Chicago in 2009 and I would crash on people, my friends' couches and stuff. And within a few years, everyone had moved to New York or LA and now they're all writing on shows and they've got specials and they're doing things. And so it's like having a peer group that's excelling helps motivate and push you. Because it's like, when I would go to these places, I wouldn't feel like, oh man, I'm behind them. I'm like, oh, I'm right with them. Like, even though I can't afford to live in this city, my comedy still stands out in this city when I come here. I don't feel like I'm like a country bumpkin, like, oh, I'm, you know, because that happens sometimes where like a road dog, a person who just goes to clubs, will then go into New York and like do these like all indie shows and eat a dick their whole set. Because it's not, you're not here, you're not in this moment, you just hit play and you do your act.
Yeah.
And so being able to be around all these people who are thriving helps, you know, you see the blueprint and you're like, okay, what can I take and model what I'm doing after? You know what I'm saying? And that's one of the most helpful things in this, because I think had I just stayed in Cleveland, I would have been a completely different type of comic, because I wouldn't have imported these different facets.
Yes. That idea of a road dog or a, you know, that I think we all know what that means. That's a very a beautifully American way of putting it that, again, sounds ridiculous coming out of my mouth. But I think that act becomes that kind of act because of, amongst other things, financial pressure. And I think certainly in the UK, I imagine it's reflected in the States as well, certain people can afford to do indie alt rooms that don't pay, and they can afford to take risks and experiment and, you know, come up with original stuff because they don't have the financial considerations that someone else might have. So to what extent, given that you have managed to, like, do you feel you have managed to inhabit that kind of creative part, you know, that kind of more alt, like, you could, I can absolutely see you in an alt room. Do you feel that you've managed to cling to that despite the financial pressure of not having the financial backing that maybe some of your peers had?
Well, most of
Ramon, I've just remembered it's 9 a.m. in Ohio. I just realized straight off the blocks of like, wake up, let's get into it. So thank you once again for
oh, no worries. I will say that, like, most of my, like, the DIY self-production stuff kept me economically viable. So just because, like, I feel like you can empathize with this. As a comedian, I'll do this shit for free every night just to do it. Like, that for a long time, that's the mindset. Where it's like, I just want to do this as much as I can, wherever I can, however I can. And so it went from every night is like a red, where, like, it's costing me gas or whatever to go do this free show. So then I'm producing my own shows, and I have deals with venues where they're like giving me $2 for every person that came out. Sure. So the open mic. Then I'm doing showcases where I'm getting that and charging at the door. Uh-huh. So I went from these nights where things were red to, like, now a couple times a week I got some green. I got, like, you know, I made $50 to $100 here. I made $50 to $100 there. It ain't much, but it paid my bills. It kept gas in my car. I was paying comics for their set. Like, a lot of people got paid for the first time at my shows. And all that did was show me, like, once, like, doing that and then start working at the clubs, it's like, oh, I make more money doing my own thing over here, but I get the prestige the ego boost and the outside validation here.
Yeah, that aspect of prestige is a good word, but it's something, as well as the prestige, the ego, the validation, there is some kind of nuance in prestige whereby the industry, such as it exists, and it's a principle of mine that it doesn't, it's just satellites and everyone kind of spooking like a herd, but let's say it exists, there is something whereby if you are seen to be succeeding, like, if you're, it's not quite prestige. It's like, if you are seen, or as well as prestige, you have to be seen to be succeeding without hustle so that people don't just think you're a hustler. Do you know what I mean? Because I think the inverted commas industry can look at some acts and go, oh, sure, well, he's going to be there because he's, you know, he's making it work elsewhere, rather than because he's got it on his own merit, which is an insane concept anyway, because if you look at how many successful people, it's not just merit, you know, it's not a meritocracy, and an enormous amount of things need to fall the right way.
Yeah. And I don't think any of us exist on an island. Like, so much, like, a lot of it is like the hustle from within me, but a lot of it's been cosigns from people I've met, you know, across the years, who, like, you know, as I would bring people to do shows in Cleveland, and then I travel to Chicago, to New York, or LA, each time I go, I get to do better and better shit because my network was bigger.
Yeah.
You know, hosting for this, that, or the other comic at the club. They're like, oh, you're funny. Oh, you're in LA. Come do my show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you know, same with you. Like, when we met in South by Southwest.
Yeah.
We hung out in Edinburgh, and now we're doing this podcast.
Sure, right.
It's a slow burn, but it's like it came partly from my hustle, but it came from the connection we established by just vibing. Like, we vibed in South by Southwest.
Sure.
Even though we didn't really know each other. And, you know, like, I'd heard your podcast before, but, like, I appreciate what you do. You know what I'm saying? Like, I respect and appreciate your position in the game. But I'm not familiar with the UK.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I had context for you, but I didn't know your context within the game. I was just like, oh, this dude's cool. He does this thing. He's cool. I like his vibe. I'm going to fuck with you.
So this is Ramon Rivas. Great fun talking to him. You can hear, I think if you've, I'm not sure when this bit is dropping in yet in the middle of the episode, but I think by now you should have had the moment where Ramon says to me, a quintessentially English person, you know, it was a sentence that ended with, I'll fuck with you, you know? And what he meant was, I'll deal with you, I'll get on with you. And he was like, yeah, I really like you. That's why I'll fuck with you. And you could, I wish you could have seen my face. Because I was like, oh, I totally get that. But that's the first time anyone in my life has said that they would fuck with me. And what an experience that was. So listen, more from Ramon shortly. You can go, of course, to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get 40 minutes of extras, including if you too wish to live in abundance, despite a lack of financial privilege, then there are some kind of eyebrow raising tactics that Ramon suggests for I won't go into them. I'm going to just save them. So this is clickbait, but there it is. There are some really fascinating things which are kind of A, usable if you are so inclined, B, funny, and C, certainly an insight on how Ramon's mind works. So plenty more hustle to come. And in the extras, also, if you are in the Insiders Club, you can get hold of the exclusive Insiders Zoom Q&A that we did with James Acaster. And there is another one in the diary for a couple of weeks from now with Mr. Nish Kumar. So look forward to those. If you're thinking about joining the Insiders Club, jump in now and you will get, I'll make sure just before we do it, I'm going to tell everyone about it on the Insiders mailing list today. But if you join between now and when it happens, I'll chuck out another mail out that morning to make sure we scoop up any newbies. That's all for now. It's not all for now. Let's get back into it. But you can remember, you can go to blazerramon.com or follow Ramon on Twitter at blazerramon. I'm saying Ramon different when it's after the word blazer. Blazer Ramon. I'm fudging it every time. It's Ramon, but it could also be Ramon, depending on how English you are. Here he is.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. Bet you get 30, 30, bet you get 30, bet you get 20, 20, 20, bet you get 20, 20, bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to talk to you about Edinburgh and your experiences there, but let's continue for people who don't know you. Let's continue the comedy credentials. One of the things I love, I've said that word nuance a moment ago, but I see you as a very nuanced comic because you are so, and I don't want to keep saying laid back, but you're so kind of as you have a line about seeming like you perpetually just woke up from a nap, like that kind of slow, soft energy. It's like, it reminds me kind of like a martial art where it's a kind of like Aikido. Do you know what I mean? It's not about striking. It's just about, oh, and look, and now suddenly you're in charge, you know?
Yeah.
And typified, I think, I really like the word super duper. In an opening line that I've seen you use on various sets on your album and stuff, you know, I'm living with my sister because it's super duper free. And the use of super duper is so just soft. It's such a silly little rounded word, like right from the off first line, it has this kind of softness to it. Now, I was listening to one of your I think you've remastered one of your albums or some older stuff you just recently put on Spotify in a kind of pandemic pivot. We'll get to that. But listening to that, there was some material which I hadn't heard from you before, which was about the way that you deliberately sound like you just woke up from a nap in order to be safe existing in America. And so I wanted to talk about not just the cultural context of that, but also the extent to which that softness is a choice in your life and the extent to which that softness is a choice on stage.
So a lot of those realizations came from Edinburgh because it was such a shocking culture. Like, it was weird because when I landed in Edinburgh, I'd been in LA for so long, I landed, I was like, why does this feel familiar? Like, it felt, I didn't feel uncomfortable because it reminded me so much of Cleveland. Like, as far as like the weather was like nice, and then it'd be rainy, and then it'd be shitty, and then it'd be nice again, and then it'd be rain. That's Cleveland all day.
Okay.
And so, and then the cut of the people was similar, like just kind of working class. Y'all are just existing for the now. You're not chasing anything. You just, boom, you're having a pint, you're having some fish and chips, you're chilling. And then people started processing me as white, which was such a jarring, because that's one thing I could never be in America. And so I started to have this realization of like, am I this chill as an adaptation, in the sense of like, when there's a squirrel that lives in the desert, they grow like a dark stripe down their back to cope with the sun.
Yeah, yeah.
So am I this chill because it's the safest way for me to exist in this body? And the logic behind that is I've always been big. Like I said earlier, I feel like I've always been big, broken, brown. When I was in kindergarten, I was the size of a third grader. When I was a third grader, I was the size of like a sixth grader. And when I was in fifth grade, I was the size of my dad. Me and my dad wore the same exact size clothes when I was in fifth grade.
Okay.
So I've been the size of a man since I was in fifth grade. And then I got bigger, right? And so that comes with a weird responsibility that you don't really realize. And the case I can point to specifically is Tamir Rice. So Tamir Rice was a 12-year-old, again, size of a man. So same age, like when I was the same size as my dad, I was 12. So Tamir Rice was 12 years old at a park playing with a toy gun. Someone called the cops like, hey, I think this kid has a toy gun. He's kind of pointing at people. And they rolled up and they shot him within a second of pulling up on him. And he was just a kid who didn't realize what his size meant to other people. Mm. And so I've always had that, this vague awareness. I think because people always made fun of me for being big, I was hyper aware of it. And so I just kind of always automatically would shrink myself down for the comfort of others. Because if I take up the proper amount of space, you may be like, oh, intimidated by that. You know, like I that's kind of where that line, like the sound like I woke up from a nap comes from. Like I say I was impatient and indignant when I was in Scotland. And it was beautiful because I don't get to do those things in America.
Yeah, right.
If I'm impatient or indignant here, that's aggressive.
Yeah.
And aggressive in my body is dangerous. And those are all realizations I had in Scotland, but that had already been baked into me.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't realize that that was what happened until that happened. I'm like, well, look, what's going on?
Yeah, you're kind of like, you're almost on, I mean, not on vacation, obviously you're working, but just to be in a space where you're allowed to be impatient. Yeah, like you get a sense of, oh, this is what privilege is like. Oh.
Yeah, and like the, what do I want to say? The sensibility of whiteness over there, like I was allowed to be white in the UK because it doesn't mean the same thing it means in America. And that's such a weird thing to try to explain to white people in America. But seeing those cracks and things while I was in Scotland helped me kind of start to figure that type of shit out.
Yeah.
But it was, it's just such a weird thing to like, and all this global unrest that's been happening during the pandemic, like all the racial injustice, having that come out, like that, the impetus of that, like the feeling behind all of that is what's always in the back of my head, just in the operating procedure. Mm. Like, and so it's kind of relieving that now it's something everyone's aware of. Like, okay, I'm not just crazy for having this feeling. But it's a hard thing to sometimes it feels like an irrational fear. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want it to cripple me, but it is something I always have to be aware of. And I don't know what type of experience I can, like, correlate that to make it understandable for people who haven't had to think like that.
Sure.
But yeah, that's kind of been, my voice is like this just because this is how it is, but like, you know, I've always been chill. I've always been relaxed. I smoke a lot of weed, so that makes it extra chill. I think it's a mix of both. It's a nature and a nurture thing. Because it's easier for me to exist around people if I'm not viewed as an aggressive or imposing entity. And on stage, I'm lifted up from you already, and I'm bit, like, so having that soft, laid back approach keeps me from people being like crossing their arms or like adjusting to my physicality without me saying anything.
Have you experimented with other, or did you in the early part of your comedy career, did you ever experiment with different ways of being on stage, or did you step out being pretty much, you know, what is now your comedy persona?
I mean, it takes a lot of failing into yourself to find your true persona. I will say that, like, early on, I was trying to write jokes like I've heard before. Yeah. And what I mean by that is I would sit with something and I'd read it and then I'd write jokes off of it. Just kind of like the formulaic, like, this happened in the news and da-da-da-da-da. And I would struggle to remember that stuff because I didn't really give a fuck about it. But I was, like, trying to do the traditional, like, well, this is what jokes sound like, and this is where, and I was opening for one of my buddies at some colleges, and we did, like, a chunk of them, and then there was a break, and then we did another chunk, and during the break, I wrote some jokes, and then so at the start of the second run, I did them, and I was doing terribly, to the point where his manager said, like, hey, he can't perform at these other schools, right? And so I'm like, all right, cool. He's like, I'll still pay you. Like, it's whatever. Because we were, like, somewhere in Pennsylvania. He's like, I'll still pay you. It's whatever. But so I was like, okay, cool. So we're just sitting and smoking. And I'm talking about my family. I'm talking about my sister and her kid. I'm talking about my dad. I'm talking about my mom. And he's like, oh, this is what you should be talking about. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know all this shit. You care about it. So, like, it's not going to be as hard for you to remember as other shit. I was like, oh yeah, that's a good call. And so that informed me, just because up to that point, I was trying to find common ground with the audience so that they would connect with me. You know what I'm saying? Like, have you guys ever drank so much you threw up driving to work? Like that type of shit. And so then I hard pivot from that to just specifically talking about my experience. And in doing that, I started having more people connect with me because they'd be like, oh, you remind me so much of my cousin or my brother or my friend. Like, I started to, by being the most me or honoring me more fully, there's a lot of people who are like me, but there's no one exactly like me. So, like, that's what I started to tap into, like 3 or 4 years into comedy. And then also, you know, I was going to these other cities, so I'd see these fucking just monsters at open mics still. So, like, I saw, like, Drew Michael, who's got, like, an HBO special. He taped his Comedy Central special same time as me. He's got such a dark lean to how he does comedy, and it's so specific and meticulous. So, like, seeing someone like that at a mic, it's like, damn, okay. Lisa Traeger Megan Gale, I started seeing these people who were just not fully formed, but they were already shades of what they were going to be.
Yeah.
And so that kind of helped me feel competent too. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting with Lisa in particular. I don't know there's other names, but Lisa's been on the show and she is a case in point of someone who is like, oh, you're being 100% yourself. You're being precisely and absolutely exactly what you are and not trying to be relatable in any way and just like, oh, this is me, this is it.
Yeah. That takes a certain amount of fearlessness to do that, because it is like, you know, at the end of the day, you're up there seeking attention and connection. And doing that without any regard for the other people's connection to you is scary and jarring at a certain point. But it's like, that's where a lot of growth happens once you let go of that, like, need to be connected, if that makes sense.
Do you feel like you've let go of that need?
To a certain extent, yeah. I mean, I've let go of that need in the context of what I talk about. One of the clubs that I'm like came up in, it's, you know, they say mainstream or dinnery, it's just a white club. And
I saw this on your Twitter feed talking about the word dinnery to describe white people. Like, I don't think it's directly translatable over here. I feel like I know what you mean though.
Yeah. And it's just like, I get what you're saying, but like, you know, It code switching is whatever. But so there was a time I was home from when I was in LA. I asked to open for this comic, not because I liked them, just because I saw they didn't have a host or feature with them. So I was like, oh, if I can grab that, I'm here. And the manager was like, can you not piss off his crowd for 10 minutes? And I was like, yeah, and just moved on. But I don't think he realized the depth of like disrespect in that statement. And so because it was just going to be like a white, basic white crowd. And it's like, I've worked here for so long. Why would you think I couldn't do that? First of all, but then, all right, fuck you. I'm still going to talk about. So I did that chunk about going to Edinburgh, which talks about like race and poverty. And I did exactly what I normally do. And had the owner come up to me at the end of the weekend, like, yo, I got a lot of really great compliments about you. Great job.
Yeah.
Now, I said all that to say, like, I didn't give a fuck that the manager was like, well, can you do that? I didn't give a fuck that this crowd may have certain, like, oh, don't talk about this. Don't talk about that. I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about. And I don't give a fuck if all of you like it or not, there's someone in this room who'll fuck with it. And getting to that mindset was important, because if I wasn't in that space and they had said that to me, then I'm in my head. I'm like, okay, you can't do this. You can't do that. Hey, hi, everybody. How anyone celebrate? Like you're living to please someone who don't know comedy.
Yeah.
Like you can say that to me, but you can't go up on stage and not bomb in front of these people. You'll make them mad immediately. But you, because of your position, you presume to be able to tell me what to do or how to serve it. It's like, that's my artistic position.
Just putting the shoe on the other foot for a second, as someone that runs clubs, have you ever felt that you needed to say to people before they go on, hey, listen, I know what you do, and it would be great if you inflected it in this direction? Like, have you ever been in the position, having identified that kind of how wrong that is for someone to say that, have you ever been in that position yourself? Can you see where that comes from?
I can see where that comes from. As someone who produced shows, like my care consideration as a producer is different than my consideration as a comic.
Yeah.
As a producer, if I set the room up right, and got the music going, set a vibe, the audience comes in, they're feeling good, they're loose. Now I've set it up to where, like, you're only going to bomb if you're meant to. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like this crowd's not shitty. They're not like they're in a mode, they're in a zone. We'll go. And so if I do that right, I shouldn't have to worry about you doing well. Now, as I ran shows, I do like open mics where it's still that, but like, I don't know any of these people. These are random people who emailed me. I gave them a date and now they're here. So then I just be like, I'll give you the light at 4 minutes and you get off at five. And if they're bombing, I just give them a light at two. I just pull them down a little early. It's not my place to tell you what to do. That's your journey to figure out. But I was out of town once and I had a bunch of people texting me like, yo, this dude at this open mic's being mad racist. Someone got up and threw a chicken wing at him, right? And I'm like, damn, you had to be real racist because like no one's ever thrown a chicken wing at anybody. And so I had to, when I got home, I ran into the dude at the mic. I was like, yo, can we talk? And I told him, I was like, yo, I'm sure you're not racist. I'm sure that's not what your intention is, but that's how you're coming across. And so I probably won't have you on the mic for a while as you figure that out, but feel free in a few months to hit me up. So like that was my position after the fact, after someone threw a whole ass chicken wing at you. But I didn't, before he said, I wasn't be like, hey, don't do no racial shit, blah, blah, blah. Like,
sure.
You sink or swim on your own, bro. If you know, I as someone who has bombed, like that chunk about going to Edinburgh bombed a whole bunch the first time I did it, the first dozen times I did it. But it's something I wanted to talk about, so I kind of figured it out.
And that piece, what I love about that, the Edinburgh story, is that you really are getting into some stuff in a way that is, like, when I heard that bit, I was like, oh, hello. Do you know what I mean? Like it's better. It's kind of an improvement. It's better. You know, I know that's a meaningless term and I don't even know you that well, but like for me, I was like hearing that, I was like, whoa, that's gone up a gear and I think it's like leaning into what's meaningful and leaning into what's actually important to you is enabling you to talk about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that was, you know, a lot of just that trial and error, but like, I feel like if I'm playing the game for someone else's comfort, I may never have even touched that Edinburgh chunk because it's like immediately I know talking about race is uncomfortable for people, talking about whiteness is uncomfortable for people, talking about how it's a construct is uncomfortable for people. And so it's like all the immediately three discomforting notions in this piece of material that if I weren't so laid back, I might not be able to touch because, you know, if I was up there like, white people, y'all trash, that's an arm crossing immediate type of thing. I hate when people tell me that type of shit, but I understand where it comes from. That's why I don't get mad about it. But I still can be like, fuck you.
So talk to me about Latino comedy or because I know you did the Entre Nos?
Entre Nos, yeah.
Entre Nos, so the HBO Max thing, which was kind of Latino comedy, which I don't know if that is even the politically correct term. Is it Latinx comedy? I don't even know how to pronounce that. I've seen on Twitter. I have no idea how to pronounce Latin with an X at the end.
I think it's just Latinx or Latinx. I don't know. That's one of those new things that started popping up a few years ago.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm glad you don't know either. I now feel like that's less of an invalidating hole in my own knowledge.
Yeah. No, you're just as invalid as me. So when I did that HBO Latino special, that came from the guys who booked me for South by Southwest.
Okay.
Because for South by Southwest, I was initially only supposed to do the Latino showcase the first night of it and then leave. But they asked me to do it. I was like, cool. Can I get a pass for the festival? And they're like, oh, let's check. They're like, yeah, you can get a pass. I was like, cool. Can I stay longer if I'm getting the pass? And they're like, okay, yeah, we'll cover your hotel till Sunday. I was like, okay, cool. If I have somewhere to stay, can I get a buyout on that hotel? So I wound up like getting a little more like, you know, than they were initially offering me. And I just stayed at some people I knew from Cleveland who lived down there. who used to just come to my shows that I ran at bars, and they liked me enough to let me stay in their guest room. And so I just stayed the whole, after the comedy ended, I was still in South by Southwest going to music shows. And so these dudes who I never met them before, but they saw me, they liked me. They brought me out for that. And then that kind of developed a rapport. And then so it's not an HBO production. It is a Viva Pictures production that they then sell to HBO.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, potato, potato, but like that's kind of important because it's like, it's not an HBO, like HBO money is different than Viva Pictures money.
Got it.
You know? And so they asked me to do this. I'm like, that's cool. I don't speak Spanish. Like, I know I am Hispanic. I'm Mexican. I'm Puerto Rican. But I don't speak Spanish. Is that okay? They're like, yeah, that's fine. It'll be subtitled. So it's funny that, like, it is in English and then subtitled in Spanish.
And do you do the bit? Do you do the bit? I couldn't get that set. I can't access it over here. But in that set, do you do the bit about, you know, ordering turkey sandwich with someone who is...
I think I did. I believe that thing I did for HBO, I was talking more about... like sexual power dynamics.
Okay.
In that set, but I think I used that turkey sandwich thing as like the setup for me.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
And then that was just before I went to Edinburgh. So that was like the summer before I went to Edinburgh. So like I was kind of like my thesis for Edinburgh was accounting for my social position, its impact on how I navigated sex, right? And so the HBO Latino special was that thesis in a shorter set. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I was working towards I'd never gone to Edinburgh. I'd never built a show like that before. So everything leading up to that, if I was doing a 5-minute set, I was trying to hit that thesis. If I was doing a 30-minute set, I was trying to hit that thesis. If I was headlining, I was trying to hit it. And just to go to Edinburgh and continue to just work through this thing. So when I came back to America, I had something to tour with.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So with respect to Edinburgh, do you find that now you hustle, you go to festivals. Did you have like an hour long set before you went to Edinburgh? Or was it like an hour, like a headline thing is what kind of 40 to an hour?
Yeah, headlining's here like 45.
Okay.
I think the year before that I headlined Hilarities in Cleveland and I did everything I had and I think I did like 67 minutes, right?
Okay.
And so then from there I started building the specific Edinburgh act or the thesis towards that. So I was using some of the things I'd already done in support of the thesis. So it kind of shifted how I was using things. Cause like I'd always talked about dating. I'd always talked about my family. I'd always talked about poverty, but I never talked about how interconnected those things all are. And so that's what I started to explore. So I had a base of, you know, this 20 minutes is funny. It works already. It will build a rapport with the audience to then I can talk about this other shit I want to talk about.
Okay.
And so in Edinburgh, I was really accordioning it out. Like I was treating it like when Rocky goes to the mountains.
Training, I think we all did.
Right. I was rooming with Alex Edelman and I was telling him like, oh yeah, I'm just training Rocky in the mountains. He's like, oh yeah, this is the fight for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, oh, yeah, everyone uses it differently, but that just completely blew my mind to like, oh, yeah, y'all have shit done when you're doing this.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think a lot of US acts make that mistake, or not necessarily a mistake, but they're by taking a particular approach, I know what a lot of people have found is that they've come to Edinburgh and then on like their first preview, they've had all of the major press in because they're like, oh, someone American who's new, we haven't reviewed before. They're all excited. They made an effort. You know, chances are the bigger American acts have got PR. The PR has been good PR because Americans are like, oh, I'm going to lose my shirt here. So I'll spend all the money I've been told to spend. And as a result, they're kind of stumbling around, cobbling together, you know, some notes and some ideas on day one. And then they get a really, you know, a raft of difficult reviews. Again, something in people in the States not that used to getting reviewed.
Yeah.
So that can be, that's really funny. Of course, I mean, I know Alex well, as you know, and the idea that that is the fight for him, of course. I can absolutely hear him saying that.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that's one of those things that I didn't know that y'all don't like unfinished things. Because technically it should have been like a work in progress is what I should have labeled it as.
Sure.
But I didn't know anything about the context of what Edinburgh was, aside from like I saw the documentary that Hannibal made, The Hannibal Takes Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Which like really just made me want to go more than anything, just because even though I have the credits, even though I have headline, I don't like Edinburgh. Those doing my hour 21 times, it was supposed to be 24, but a couple got canceled because of no crowd. That's the most I've ever gotten to headline to that point. Like if you added up all the headline shit I did before Edinburgh, that still was more than I'd ever gotten to do before. So it was indescribably beneficial to be able to do that. I'm a big proponent of failing anonymously. So like being able to do that. And like, there was a night where it was just a couple, it was a husband and a wife. And I went through my shit and it was very conversational. We're talking. And at the end, they're like, man, we're going to go home and talk to our son about sex and dating and shit, just like you made as well. I'm like, oh, okay, good, cool. But like, it would be nice to go back and have like a proper finished thing and try to get people to come see that finished product versus like, I was my own street team. I was doing shit, but I also knew that like, I just need a little bit of y'all so I could work on this shit. Now, the more of you there are, the more energy it will, like, the better it will be. But because I'm just working out, I just need a few of y'all. So it would, you know, and that was me going, I went to Edinburgh with, I think, $2,000 or $2,500. So my flight out was like less than $5,000. My lodging was $15,000. So I lived in Edinburgh with $500 for a month. Which is like not like people go out there with like $10,000 to just pay their street team.
Absolutely. I've gone quiet because I'm like, all right, now we're going to get how to do Edinburgh poverty efficiently. how to do Edinburgh as financially efficiently as possible.
Yeah. And so like, you know, Alex found where we stayed, which was super centrally located. A little pricey, like my half of the rent was $1,500. Like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. You know, I had saved up and I was like, okay, cool, boom. And then I'm just good at budgeting. So, like, I, you know, would buy groceries, I cook for myself. I don't drink. So, that was a great less money to spend. And then I had a random fan who he listens to Doug Benson's podcast. He just was like, when you're in Edinburgh, I got weed for you. I was like, cool. And he brought me so much. He brought me a bunch of weed and I was like, thank you, which saved me a lot. Cause he told me that like an ounce of weed is like 500 pounds, which is like $700 American, which is like 2-3 times as much as it costs in the States.
Sure. Okay.
So like that, like I would have just not smoked weed if it weren't for that dude. And it was so helpful to have weed to process all this, like, oh, I'm white over here. And Yeah, just like I didn't have a street team budget. Like I didn't have the budget to do the things you should do in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But I had enough to, well, I went to the little consignment shops and I bought like some cool pants. Like, you know, I still did the things I enjoyed doing. I'm just so used to, I guess, balling on a budget is how I'll put it. Me and Megan Gailey did a pilot presentation. It was a travel show. And the concept was like highbrow, lowbrow, like experience the city from like a highbrow perspective.
Oh, it's a great idea.
Perfect. And we were perfect for it because she's very like, you know, comes from like a wealthy family, but is very grounded. Mm. But the things she wanted to do were very like tailgate at a sporting event and like go to bars. It's like, well, that's kind of lowbrow, even though you're the highbrow thing. And I wanted to like go to the art museum and like do shit that was, so it was an interesting juxtaposition. But my experience is all kind of, that fit me so perfectly because that's just how I exist.
Yeah.
Like I'm rich in moments in time. Like comedy's taking me all over the world, but I'm socioeconomically still in the same spot. But because I grew up the same way, I know how to like I keep my sense of needs and wants low so I can feel some sense of abundance. So even though I didn't have money in Edinburgh, just being there was a flex. Like I had a month-long vacation where I broke even.
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? Like that's,
yeah, right.
That's not like that. That's not successful Edinburghing, but that's successful vacationing.
Do you think that whole kind of mentality of living in abundance by having lower how did you put it? Not by lower expectations,
needs and wants are low so that sometimes I'll feel abundant. Because if my needs and wants are up here, but my experiences are all down here,
yeah.
Well, now I'm always feeling less than.
Of course, of course. And if I'm
down here, my experiences are here, then I'm feeling like, oh, look at me, I'm out here crushing it.
Sure. I'm just wondering whether like, I do that sometimes about, I'm inquiring now as to whether I'm doing that when I say to myself, hey, you know, one of my great notions is, I just reminded myself of Fry and Futurama. What do you call that thing? A headache with pictures, an idea. That's it. One of my notions about comedy is that Chris Rock, best part of Chris Rock's day is he thinks of a new joke on the way to the show and then does it and it gets something. That's the best part of the show, right? And that's mm-hmm. like, it's a notion for me because I get to have that. So I'm wondering if I'm doing a similar thing about like I'm living artistically in abundance despite being at the level of like a huge comic. And I just wondered, like I spot myself doing that and I don't know whether I feel like noble or like a loser for doing it. You know what I mean? It's like there's always two sides of that perspective.
Well,
if you look at it like this, I'm a huge success, you know, and like, for example, I have the love of my two children. I am a successful man. Well, that's what you would need to say if you weren't so successful. Do you know what I mean? There's always just a perspective on it. And I just wonder how you feel about that as regards abundance in your career. Like, I suppose what we're talking about is whether you are grateful for what you have versus feeling like you deserve more or desire more, or, you know, like, you know, I've had peers who have gone on to be more successful. Like, where do you sit on that as per your kind of happiness?
I'm grateful for everything I have. I am hopeful for more. I don't expect more. I don't feel like I'm entitled to more. I feel like what I am may warrant more, but that's outside of my hands. And I try not to, how do I put this? So like there's a thing in America they do in a bunch of different cities called 50 First Jokes, where the very beginning of the year, 50 some comics go up on stage and they do the first new joke they've written. Right.
Okay.
And I did it in Cleveland for a few years. just as kind of like a community building. And I think that's beautiful, because regardless of I got this, that, the other credits, this other motherfucker is barely a comedian, but we're both on the same footing. We're both here trying a new thing. And that's the same mindset I have when I go to open mics. We all here, we're all the same, it's not a big deal. But then other people will be like, why are you here? And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, well, you have this, that, and the other. Why are you here? I'm like, oh, because we're still the same. Like, it's a weird, like, yes, I have these things, but they do not define me. They don't complete me. They're just, it's the same as being like, well, you have that cool shirt. Why do you still have, why do you still buy shirts? You know? So like, that always exists in me, that thing that we're all the same. Like, I'm on no better footing than you. You're on no better footing than me. We're both doing the same thing with our own take and spin. And I think doing that may be like an adaptive thing in my brain, so that I don't let my ego build. Does that make sense? Like, it's a constant battle of ego and id. And I never want to live for my ego. And because the times where I've lost that centering and have started to, I didn't like how it felt. But it's weird because this is a very egotistical business. And the people who I see comfortable flexing their ego generally cut the line. But that, I feel like that's...
You mean in the sense of they get there sooner?
And yes, but I also think that's because they feel entitled to it. Yeah. And so they're like, you know, if someone walks in like, where's my coffee? You're just going to get them coffee.
Thanks so much to Ramon Rivas II for coming on the show. An absolute joy to have you. Thank you to all of the usuals. Pete Dobbing, your podcast consultant. Music by Rob Smerton. Logging by Jake Crossland. And, of course, Nathan Wood was your uploader, editor, and generalissimo. Yeah, that's fine. Loads more on the insiders, so jump on that. Also, Nish Kumar coming up for a private insiders Q&A. And the one we did with James Acaster, that will be recorded. If you're an Insiders Club person and you can't make it on the day, it will be recorded. It will be available to listen to on the private podcast. The one we did with James Acaster is still up there. And I tell you what, I love doing those. And we're going to have some in. I think we're going to do one with Olga. I think we're going to do one with Tom Neenan as well. I just particularly enjoy them, not least because they completely shuck away all of the kind of trodden in anxiety that I seem to feel when I do anything with anyone. The fact of like the structure of me just kind of facilitating people in the Insiders Club who are self-selecting comedy fans, super fans, is just incredibly satisfying and fun. So if I could do one of them a day for the rest of my life, why don't we work our way back through the ComCom back catalogue doing Insiders Q&As? How many of them can you take if you want to turn up, get in a Zoom room with someone brilliant, and get to ask them some questions whilst I just sort of sit there enjoying myself, chipping in and occasionally being ready to go, whoa, 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 that's a bit personal, which I haven't needed to so far, but who knows? So that is all that. Oh my God, I've got 7 minutes to post-amble at you. I'm going to use every seven of them. That's all for now for the episode. Blazer Ramon and blazerramon.com and at Blazer Ramon. And everything I'm up to is also on the show notes. Do check out the new website, stuartgoldsmith.co.uk. It took a long time. and it contains links to all of the things I'm doing, and I'm doing lots of things. So check them out. Send me some feedback if you like. Will that make people go and visit it? The possibility of giving me feedback. There's a great thread on the Facebook ComCom group whereby I asked, what's your least favourite thing about my website? And you guys told me, so thanks for that. That's all for now. See you next week. Next week's episode already in the can with Loyeso Gola. And I've got some fabulous recordings with two fabulous comedy acts coming up in the next couple of days. So plenty more to come. See you soon. Bye for now. C'est So here we are. Here's a little thing. I now have 5 minutes within which to record a postamble. And I keep the last three episodes haven't had one because I've been too busy. Well, the kids are back at school. Well, one of them is the Boutros is back at school. As a result, we only need to deal with Future Girl. And as a result of that, things are a little calmer. Although, and this may become an issue pertinent to all of us as the pandemic hopefully grinds to a halt, ends, clears up. We had a pandemic, but it cleared up. I have been putting things off till now, thinking, oh, I'll get round to that when the Boutros is back at school. And now, of course, it's not some hazily defined future point at which I'll need to get things done. It's right now. Oh, God. And I wonder whether that will be writ large. That will become a macro issue in the months and years to come, whereby all of the stuff that we thought, well, I can just ignore this for the moment, there's a pandemic on, whether it's all going to come crashing back to bother us. Let's be more positive than that. But I did see, here's a note, which I do think is positive. I was catching up with one of my favourite podcasts, Boars, Gore and Swords, which started life many years ago as a Game of Thrones accompaniment kind of book club, you know, like TV episode, a recap? I can't remember the genre. But now they just tell you what you should be watching. Ivan and Red, very, very funny guys. And they've been a constant companion for many years. I got back into it because I finally got up to date with WandaVision. As a result, the last nine eps have been about WandaVision, so I couldn't go near them for fear of spoilers. And I'm getting there. And something they mentioned in passing is that after Spanish flu, there were next to no cultural artifacts created about it, right? So after whenever that was, 100 or so years ago, very few people at the end of that pandemic made art about the pandemic. They didn't draw pictures, make paintings and write novels about it. Everyone just got on with it. And I think is there not a movie coming out fairly soon with, oh God, I saw it advertised. I forget who's in it even, but it's like, it's a movie called Lockdown or something like that. Locked Down. Is it with Chiwetel Ejiofor and someone else? There is a feeling, like I saw that a film exists and I went, oh, I don't want to be reminded of that. And Ivan and Red were talking about how someone in this TV show had wore a mask and they found it really jarring. And anyway, the upshot is, look, we don't need to make art about the pandemic at the end of the pandemic. We are all going to be absolutely sick to the back teeth of it. And we can just pretend as a world that it never happened. Those of us lucky enough to be on the recovering side of it. But the point I made on Twitter, and I will make to you now, is that maybe if you're writing a show about the pandemic, just don't bother. Just pretend that this is what I wanted. I've gambled on that being the case. I think I'm in celebratory mode because I have gambled on no one wanting to hear about the pandemic. And as a result, written next to no jokes about the pandemic. I thought, that's not going to work. What's the point? That's wasted time. That's like writing a joke about, you know, I never write jokes about TV because I think they're alienating if you haven't seen the TV thing. I don't write a lot of topical stuff because if I'm going to bother writing a joke, I want to be able to use it forever. A terrible attitude, I now realise. But with that attitude in mind, when everything went tits up last year, I thought, well, I'm not going to write jokes about this because they're not going to last beyond it. So anyway, history has proved me right retrospectively, but history, it remains to be seen, doesn't it, whether history will prove me right in the future. Thank God I've run out of time. That'll have to do for now. Thank you once again to Ramon. Thanks for listening. Get on the Insiders Club for that Nish Kumar thing if you haven't already, and I will speak to you next week with Lawyer Sugola as we discuss his forthcoming Netflix special, which he recorded in COVID times with a socially distant audience. Plenty to talk about there. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.